And hello, my name is Don Ecker. This is the new edition of Dark Matters Radio, heard right here on Lamphere Productions. Being the first show of 2006, I wanted to have a very special broadcast. And let me tell you, we have a very special show. My guest is a gentleman by the name of Terry Hansen. Mr. Hansen has written what I feel is one of the most important books currently in UFO literature. The name of his book? The Missing Times, News Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up. Now, in today's world, where we are confronting terrorism globally wide, and a lot of charges throughout the United States about media complicity in not reporting the facts, or perhaps over-reporting unimportant facts, taking your attention away from the things that are truly important, I think this will show that it's not only in the political arena, but it's in many other arenas. All we have to do is go back a little over 10 years ago and think about news stories that were vastly underreported. For example, charges of Chinese communists making political contributions affecting the political landscape. Charges of espionage that were never fully explained to the American public. We the people who make it all possible. Well, as we are going to find out, it also goes in many other arenas. And of course, the arena that we're most concerned about here is one that many people laugh at. And Terry, I want to thank you for joining us on Dark Matters. And again, let me compliment you on your book. It is outstanding.
Well, thank you, Don, and thanks for having me on.
Okay, when we open up The Missing Times, one of the first things that confronts us is a very telling quote from the 16th President of the United States, Abraham Lincoln. Let me give that quote to the listening audience. If you once forfeit the confidence of your fellow citizens, you can never again regain their respect and esteem. It's true that you may fool all of the people some of the time. You can even fool some of the people all of the time. But you can't fool all of the people all of the time. Now, why did you start out The Missing Times with that?
Well, I think that the book The Missing Times is really about deception and how deception has worked historically, and specifically how it has been used to fool people about the UFO situation. And I think the message I like to leave people with is that, you know, there are a certain number of people who nevertheless manage to see through all the deceptions and censorship and propaganda, and in the end, I think the truth will come out.
Back in 2000, and I believe it was 2001, yes, in the October-November edition of UFO Magazine, I reviewed your book. And I basically stated there were two books that I felt one must have in your library if you're genuinely interested in this topic. The first book was Richard Dolan's UFOs and the National Security State. The second book was The Missing Times. Now, while reading your book, one of the items that you went into in some depth concerned a 1966 broadcast by CBS News, hosted by none other than legendary newsman Walter Cronkite. Now, Terry, I recalled that program. Now, maybe I'm giving my age away, but I watched that when it was first run, and I have an audio copy of that program that I just played the other day. And looking at it with hindsight, of course, which is 2020, the idea of what CBS did, very possibly in connection with intelligence organizations like the Central Intelligence Agency, it just blew up in my face listening to that. It was so obvious that this was a cover-up. What are your feelings about that? I mean, you know, you talked about Cronkite, who at the time was considered one of the most trusted human beings in the United States. And do you think he would have knowingly, in connection with an organization like the CIA gone out of their way to flamboozle the public?
Well, I think it's hard to be certain, but my personal opinion is that it's hard for me to believe that Cronkite didn't know he was deceiving the public in that program, because Cronkite was an extremely well-connected guy. He had been flown on combat missions in World War II. He was best friends with one of the early directors of the Central Intelligence Agency. He was pretty knowledgeable, and to think that he could be unaware of all the evidence that had accumulated up until that time, demonstrating the reality of the UFO phenomenon, is a little hard to swallow. So I think the CBS program was, I think the people at CBS must have known about the CIA's role in this program and that it was, in fact, a propaganda film.
Well, a man with your background, and you were a technical editor, you worked in scientific journalism. What is it about this field that would take a man with your credentials risking ridicule because you deign to look at the UFO phenomenon? And that's a question I've asked everybody in a situation like your own.
Well, I think the UFO topic is simply a very important issue, not only from a scientific point of view, but also from a political or sociological point of view. It's been a kind of the elephant in the living room in American politics for over half a century now, and it's a very fascinating issue from a sociological point of view. If you go back and review the history of it, as Richard Dolan does so well in his book UFOs and the National Security State, it's just very clear that something very important has been going on, and that the whole issue has been pushed off center stage by an ongoing government project. So it raises a lot of questions about why that is and what's really happening behind the scenes. So I think anybody who's an honest journalist really has to take the issue seriously.
Well, we only have about 30 seconds, roughly, before we've got to go to break. But when we take a look at some of the huge names over the years that have ventured into this field, people like Professor Jim McDonald, who was an atmospheric physicist, when he became publicly involved in this subject, he was ridiculed to the point where some people even suspect that was the reason he committed suicide. When we come back, I'd like to get your comments on that, because I know that McDonald is somebody that you've taken a look at.
Okay.
All right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we will be back in just a moment. All right, we are back. Professor Jim McDonald, Terry, what can you tell the audience about the experience that happened to McDonald? It was tragic in retrospect.
Right. Well, McDonald was an atmospheric physicist at the University of Arizona, and he was very accomplished scientist with impressive credentials. And he got interested in the UFO topic sometime in the 60s, I guess, and began to do some serious work on the topic and challenged the official view that a lot of these UFO sightings were just natural phenomena and, you know, atmospheric illusions and so forth. And he was, because of his scientific background, he was an incredibly formidable intellectual opponent and very effective in challenging the official point of view. And he began to run into a lot of pretty underhanded opposition from people like Phil Klass and people of that nature. People had basically attacked him and tried to destroy his credibility. And he became quite depressed about the situation at one point, and partly because of personal problems and partly because of the opposition he'd run into in pursuing the UFO question, he became depressed and killed himself. That's kind of the short version, but there's an excellent book about this called Firestorm by Ann Druffel, which is highly recommended.
Yes, Ann did a tremendous job on that. She knew Professor McDonald quite well, and one of the examples of how McDonald was so wrongly treated concerned congressional hearings that he was a part of when he was trying to warn the Congress and the public about the dangers of the STS aircraft destroying the ozone layer, and was basically practically laughed out of Congress. And in fact, the man was correct, wasn't he?
Yes, he was absolutely correct. It's a pretty sad chapter in the history of science and the history of American politics.
Well, back in that time period, circa 1966, 67, 68, which in retrospect turns out to be a pretty heady time for this subject, it began with some internationally renowned sightings that took place in Michigan, involved the Air Force's Project Blue Book going up there to take a look at it, and a rather infamous remark by J. Allen Hynek, who at the time was the Air Force scientific civilian consultant, claiming that it was all swamp gas. Now, how did the news media per se treat that then? And why is then so different than now?
Well, okay, the news media was kind of divided on the swamp gas issue. The elite media, the New York Times, for example, and CBS television, came to the defense of the official version, the swamp gas theory, and said, you know, that was really what was going on. But almost all the other smaller newspapers and regional newspapers were laughing at this idea because it was so inconsistent with the reported facts of people who had observed these UFOs. So it was quite an embarrassment to the Air Force and to J. Allen Hynek that this was not well received by the media in general, with the exception of a few of the elite news organizations that had ties to the intelligence community and the military.
Well, now, when you take a look at some of the national and actually international media like the New York Times and this subject, it's curious to me in retrospect. On the one hand, they seem to be marching to the then government's tune that UFOs are simply all nonsense. But then again, today, they are ultra critical of what the government is doing in another arena, which involves the war on terrorism. What is this dichotomy? Do you know?
Well, that's kind of a complicated question, I think. But, historically, the big news organizations have cooperated with the government on a lot of national security issues. I think there may be a bit of a break in that pattern today because the policies of the Bush administration have been so extreme and so radical. And I think that some people in big media companies who in the past have cooperated with the government have begun to wonder whether that's been a good policy, and they've begun to, at least at the New York Times, to question some of the things the Bush administration is doing. But historically, even going back to World War II, when the U.S. government wanted to influence public opinion, they appealed to the big media companies to help them change the public in one direction or another. And I think initially, when the events of 9/11 occurred and when the so-called war on terrorism was launched by the Bushies, there was quite a lot of the big news companies kind of fell into line behind the Bush administration. But they've shown themselves to be very not only radical but in many respects incompetent. And I think there's been some questioning in the elite media circles as to whether it was wise to back these people.
Well, when you take a look at some of the incidents that you so brilliantly laid out in the Missing Times, and one of the stories that I've been fascinated with for going on 20 years now concerns the overflights and in some cases apparent landing by unidentified craft in our nuclear weapons launch areas and storage areas, primarily in the Dakotas and in Montana. Now, you stated in your book that you were originally put onto this by a friend that had picked up some transmissions on a scanner. Is that correct?
That's correct. I had a friend named Chuck Penson who was a radio disc jockey in Great Falls, Montana in the mid-70s, and he was a ham radio operator, and he was in the habit of listening to his VHF scanning radio, which was not as common in those days as it is today. But at any rate, he overheard transmissions from the local police and sheriff's department that UFOs were hovering over some of our ICBM complexes around Great Falls. So that kind of tipped me off to what was going on at that time, and I tried to follow up on it, but there was very little information available in the mainstream media at the national level, especially. Although the subject was, or the story was pretty well covered in the regional papers in Montana, and to this day is quite well known.
Why would not UPI or AP or somebody pick up a story of such historic importance?
Well, in my opinion, I think that a lot of these stories, if they're very sensitive, are probably censored at the AP and UPI level.
They were spiked?
That's right, and the reason for that is that the AP and the UPI and other news agencies have a long history of cooperating with the military intelligence community to filter certain kinds of stories out of the wire services.
But yet, in the almost 60 years now that this phenomenon has been recognized worldwide, the American government, the American intelligence agencies, the military have adamantly maintained that there are no national security considerations involved with UFO sightings. How do you answer that?
Well, I answer it by saying that they also denied that there was a military base at Area 51. So, you know, the reality
until very recently,
the reality is that much of what the government says is a complete lie, and it's purposely disseminated to fool the public for one reason or another. So,
but this crosses all political spectrums. This is not just a Republican thing or a Democratic thing. This goes clear across the board, doesn't it?
Yeah, it absolutely does. It's not a not a Republican or Democratic issue. It's a much bigger issue than that, I think. I think originally, when the UFO phenomenon began to manifest in great numbers back in the 40s and 50s, that the U.S. government believed that we were being invaded from outer space. In fact, in the early 50s, the Eisenhower actually made a statement, which was carried on the front page of the New York Times, denying that the world was being invaded by flying saucers, which is pretty astonishing in today's media environment to think that a president would make a statement like that.
All we have to do is go back to the 80s when Reagan was still in office, and on five public occasions he alluded to basically UFOs and ETs. He said in a number of venues, not the least which was the United Nations, how he often thought that if a evil power from up there, and he was pointing up in the sky, were to suddenly confront us, we would forget all our regional differences, and I'm paraphrasing,
right,
but we would all have to come together as the human race. Now, don't you find that exceedingly odd that a president of the United States would make that announcement in five public venues?
Yeah, it is exceedingly odd, and in fact, there's another story related to Reagan that he was viewing an early release of Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind, and he supposedly leaned over to Spielberg and said, "You don't know how close to the truth this really is." And that was verified by Spielberg's office, by the way. So, yeah, I think Reagan knew something about what was going on.
Okay, now, the government concealing this information, which I think anybody that has even one half ounce of gray matter is going to have to acknowledge, absolutely, can be traced back to basically 1953, can it? Because when I became involved in this after leaving the police department in 1986, Terry, I decided the only way that I could confront this subject was exactly the same way I would confront investigating a criminal act or a crime, and that was to go into it full bore, in depth, and just basically follow where the facts led. I did a very intensive historical retrospective for my own information, and one of the things that I basically stumbled over is something that today is relatively very well known called the Robertson Panel. Do you believe that that's where the secrecy emanated from?
Well, I think that's where the secrecy probably started before the Robertson Panel, but I think that the Robertson Panel's impact was that it began to focus on propaganda, on trying to eliminate UFO reports from the newspapers and keep the public in the dark about what was really going on. Because what the Robertson panel said was that UFOs were a national security matter, and that although they weren't a direct threat in their opinion, the public had to be perceived that the issue was not important and that they should stop following the topic and stop pursuing the truth about the matter. So they what they called a mass media program of training and debunking, with an emphasis on debunking. And at that point, the thrust of the government's policy was to heap ridicule on the subject and try to strip it of any credibility it had obtained up to that time.
Okay, we're going to have to take another very quick break. So, ladies and gentlemen, stand by, and when we come back, more with my very special guest, Mr. Terry Hansen. And we are back with my guest, Mr. Terry Hansen. Terry, the Robertson panel is probably seen as the jump gate for concealing UFO information. Now, what I found so unbelievable about it at the time when I was researching this, I found that the Central Intelligence Agency even considered bringing in public media figures like Walt Disney into the mix to help deflect attention away from the subject and, in effect, create a laughter curtain, something that we coined at UFO Magazine many years ago, around this subject. Do you believe that they were wildly successful in this?
Yes, I think they were successful in creating a laughter curtain, and I think they did achieve their objective of keeping the subject out of the mainstream press, although it took several decades of concerted effort before that really began to happen, because in the 60s and 70s, as you probably know, there was still quite a lot of press coverage of the topic of UFOs. But by the mid-70s, I would say, they had pretty much accomplished their mission, which was to keep UFOs off the front page and marginalize the topic as much as possible.
But yet there were still those cases that invariably popped to the forefront. For example, the sightings which at the time achieved worldwide renown in New Zealand. People like Dr. Bruce Maccabee even became involved in researching these. Then, of course, 1980, the Bentwaters case in the United Kingdom involving the United States Air Force, and even admission by the deputy base commander that, yeah, something really strange happened there. How do they deal with those cases that pop out now and again?
Well, they usually deal with it by trying to spin it in some way or another. The Phoenix Lights case is another example of that, where it did manage to surface, I think, originally through USA Today, and then began to get a little more coverage around the country. But the Air Force was able to persuade people that they had been dropping flares and doing other things, and so they managed to muddy the waters quite a bit about what was actually taking place. But, of course, if you talk to the eyewitnesses, the Air Force explanation doesn't quite add up.
No, and as somebody who's seen a lot of military flares dropped when I was in the military, I can tell you that when I looked at those photographs and when I called down there when the case was brand new a few years ago, I spoke with an Air Force spokesperson, I spoke with local authorities, I was amazed at how this what I saw as a bogus explanation managed to float in the media. Now, even City Councilwoman Frances Barwood, who wanted to publicly take a look at this, ended up being ridiculed in the press. Is that their weapon of choice when public figures become involved in these kind of cases?
Yeah, I think they use character assassination, basically to strip the credibility of anyone who steps out of line and doesn't go along with the official program. So there are real risks in speaking out, and if you do have a high level of achievement in some field, academia or wherever, you know, people are pretty well aware that you're going to be singled out and attacked, as Jim McDonald was attacked. And so I think most people are not willing to take that risk, and they just keep quiet. That doesn't mean they necessarily accept what the Air Force and the government has been saying, but they keep quiet, and that that sort of solves the political problem as far as the government's concerned.
Well, let's take a look at another individual who's a bit more recent than Professor McDonald, Colonel Gordon Cooper, one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts. Now, yes. Cooper wrote a book a few years ago prior to his demise, and when the book was first released, we got a copy of it. I ended up doing a book review on it, and I knew Colonel Cooper. I had met him at his Van Nuys, California office over here. Quite a gentleman. And what I found so absolutely astounding about Gordon Cooper was the fact that he was, in essence, he was fearless about speaking about his knowledge of this subject, and he paid a price for it. I don't know if you happen to go out and read any of the reviews about his book, Leap of Faith, but they were generally pretty good until they got to the UFO part. And then they gave that metaphoric finger twirling around the temple motion and relegated Cooper as another one of those UFO nutcases. And I thought that was tragic.
Yeah, well, it sure was, but very predictable, and it's been the experience of almost anyone who's challenged the official story to run into that kind of personal attack. Cooper was unusual in that he, throughout his life, was very courageous and outspoken, and not willing to knuckle under to the forces of secrecy. I think probably, you know, there's a lot that the National Aeronautics and Space Administration knows about the UFO topic, and
you think?
Yeah, and you know, I think that a lot of people think that NASA is an open organization and that they publish everything they know and so on. But NASA is very much a part of the national security establishment. It is in charge of reviewing patents, for example, that may present a danger of national security. So it's right in there with the CIA and all the other three-letter agencies as far as keeping information under wraps.
Well, you know, the thing about NASA, Terry, that I found rather striking when I was investigating and researching a lot of this, I broke a major story in 1992, and I'm sure you probably have heard about it. It was the space shuttle flight STS-48.
Right.
And its encounter with an unknown while it was flying above New Zealand and Australia. And I was able to secure an actual copy of the live video feed from NASA from a researcher back on the East Coast by the name of Don Rash. And Don had sent this to me, and he said, "Hey, tell me what you think about that." And when I looked at it, I was just shocked at what I was witnessing. So I sent it, a copy of it, to a producer I knew at CNN. And they said, "Hey, this has got to be a show on Larry King Live. So get us a skeptic, somebody that's got to take another look at the other side of this, since you're obviously the proponent for UFO reality." So I first suggested Phil Klass, that perennial favorite, and Klass, for whatever reason, declined. Then I suggested Dr. Jim Oberg, who was a NASA contract scientist, and things got very interesting from that point forward. Now, did you by any chance see that broadcast?
You know, I'm not absolutely sure. I may have seen it, but I've seen so many broadcasts over the years that it doesn't jump out at me right away.
Well, what they were trying to say at the time was that what we are looking at is wastewater from the shuttle dump.
Uh-huh.
That these were, in essence, urine crystals, frozen urine from the wastewater dump.
Right.
Now, what made this so unlikely, and I'm being really nice, Terry, The wastewater dump had not yet happened.
Yeah.
Okay? It had not yet happened. And I was positive that after that broadcast, we were going to hear from news media globally, because the King Show does go around the world. We never received one phone call about that broadcast, but do you know what we did hear happened?
What's that?
The next day, NASA encrypted that live feed.
Uh-huh.
And since the end of June 1992, there has never been another civilian witnessing events as they happen in outer space. Now, wouldn't you think that would be somewhat telling?
Yeah, well, there have been a long, as you're undoubtedly aware, there have been a long list of former NASA employees who have spoken about their experiences within NASA and things that have been covered up that they know about. So it's not a new phenomenon. I think it would be very interesting to write a book about NASA and kind of explore what their real history has been, because I think it's quite different from what the public is being fed.
Well, during your research, have you encountered the Brookings Institute report prepared for NASA back in 1961?
Oh, yes, I'm familiar with that, and I mention it in my book.
Okay. I located that originally for Professor Stan McDaniel, who at the time was working in connection with science writer Richard Hoagland. And basically what they were trying to do was to get NASA to agree, and this was prior to the Mars Observer craft, to agree to go back and re-photograph the Cydonia region on Mars, the infamous face on Mars, okay?
Yep.
And when I found that document and I read through it, I was amazed at what some of their conclusions and recommendations were. And if you recall, in the Brookings document, they stated that not if, but when extraterrestrial intelligence and or artifacts were located in our solar system, then we have to confront the question of what do we do about it? Do we keep it secret or do we announce it to the world? And if we do announce it to the world, two groups of people will be adversely affected. And do you know who those two groups of people are, Terry?
Well, I believe it was the scientists, for one, and possibly religion.
Absolutely. Religious fundamentalists and scientists and engineers. Now, do you think that even though NASA has certainly denied it, do you think that that's basically the template that they've been working on?
Yeah, I think that's basically it. But in my opinion, there's another group that is much more concerned about the impact of UFOs, and that's the business establishment or the economic status quo, because if you have access to technology that is substantially in advance of ours, it presents both opportunities and threats to the business community, and people who are well connected want to take advantage of those opportunities, and they want to avoid the downside, which is that some of those technologies may destroy their existing businesses, existing business models. And I strongly suspect that at the core of the UFO secrecy is this concern from the business community that many of our existing corporations would be put out of business or destabilized in some fashion if the technology were made public.
Well, we've got to take another break in 30 seconds, but let me throw this at you. Okay, we are currently in the price range of between $3 and $3.50 per gallon of gasoline. Now, I think everybody recognizes that there are huge and absolutely obscene profits being made by the oil cartels, the oil corporations, globally. Now, this is something that I've suggested many times over the years. What if our global economy was suddenly confronted with an energy source that was 100% efficient and totally clean? Now, it's obvious that some of those unidentified objects are, in fact, technological devices from somewhere. And it's also very obvious that those power plants weren't made in Detroit. What do you think about that?
Well, it would be a real shock to many people, and a very, you know, it would be not well received by some very powerful people in the world, that's for sure.
Absolutely. Okay, we're going to take a break, ladies and gentlemen. We will be right back with my very special guest, Mr. Terry Hansen.
It's an awfully big... There's so many different ways you can go with this.
Hang on.
Okay.
And we are back. Dark Matters and my very special guest, Mr. Terry Hansen, author of The Missing Times. And Terry, where do people find copies of your book?
Well, they can, probably the easiest way to get a hold of it is just to go on Amazon.com and type in The Missing Times, and it'll show up pretty quickly. But it's also available from the company that prints it, which is a company called Ex Libris. And you can go on their website. I think it's just exlibris.com and do a similar search and find it that way. Some bookstores do carry it, but probably not too many. The bookstores don't generally carry many UFO books, from my experience anyway, except for some of the larger ones.
Well, you have a website, don't you?
Yes. Oh, that's right. I also have a website called themissingtimes.com, and that also has information about how you can acquire the book several different ways.
Have you been considering writing a follow-up to this?
Yeah, I'm considering it. There's a couple different possibilities. One is to do an updated version, an expanded version, and the other is to explore some of the other issues that I've briefly mentioned, such as the NASA angle. I think there's a lot of interest, a lot of data there to pursue. And also, I still don't think this whole story of the UFO overflights has been told adequately.
Are you referring to Washington, D.C. in 52?
Well, no, I'm talking about the ICBM overflights and some of the so-called Northern Tier overflights that occurred in the 70s and also in the 60s. You know, the Robert Salas affair and some of those. You're probably familiar with Robert Salas, I assume.
Yes.
But I think nobody has really put all the pieces of that together. There's a lot of dots to connect there, I think.
Well, you know, back in the early 90s, another book that I, for years, have highly recommended was a book put together by Barry Greenwood and Larry Fawcett titled Clear Intent.
Yep, I'm very familiar with that.
Well, Clear Intent took a very in-depth look at UFO encounters primarily involving the military. And Fawcett and Greenwood had covered the missile launching area UFO incursions. And at the time, I was very deeply involved in mutilation research. It's not something that I've done a lot with in recent years. And quite frankly, Terry, it was very troubling. But I'll never forget, I was at a conference, and Larry Fawcett, of course, at the time was still an active duty police officer, was a lieutenant. And me being a retired police officer, we had a lot in common. We were kicking around some ideas and stories and what have you. And he told me that during the investigation that Barry Greenwood and he conducted with this story of the overflights, he had contacted a sheriff up there by the name of Wolverton. Are
yes.
you familiar with
oh,
him?
Oh, yes, Keith Wolverton.
Yes. And so they went in to a conference room where they had a map set up where these UFO sightings had occurred. And there were a lot of different colored pins on the map. So Larry walked over, and he was talking to Sheriff Wolverton, and he said, well, tell me, Sheriff. He said, what are these different pins? And the sheriff said, well, this color denotes where we found dead and mutilated cattle. This color denotes where a UFO was seen in the air. This color denotes where one allegedly touched down. And Fawcett is looking at this map, and there was just one pin in there that was pink. And he looked at it, and he saw this, and it just kind of jumped out at him. He said, well, Sheriff, he said, what's this pen? And he said, Wolverton leaned over and in a very low voice said, well, that's where we found a dead human being that was mutilated, but we don't talk about that. Mm-hmm. Now, could this have anything to do with the UFO secrecy?
Well, it may, but again, you have to be a little bit careful about what's really going on behind the mutilation phenomenon. There could be a number of different things happening, and I think one case would have to be, I'd have to have more than one case to reach that conclusion. Although I know from Bob Pratt's work in Brazil that there have been quite a few people.
Well, if you put my name into the internet web search, you'll find out the research that I did for 3 years on that subject.
Yeah.
Back in the late 80s, early 90s. And that's one of the things that I don't talk a lot about, but between you and I and the lamppost, Terry, there have been more than one case of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll have to look into that. The mutilation phenomenon was discussed in my book, but it wasn't the focus
of course.
Of my book. I was really focusing on the media and the media's reaction to the topic. But it could very well be that there's something very frightening about what's going on. I'm not dismissing that altogether, and it could be that the secrecy is well justified in the sense that the government doesn't want to create a mass panic.
Alarm a lot of people. Well, going back to the mid to late 1980s, now basically, I think most everybody that's familiar with this topic will acknowledge that information concerning this subject was almost non-existent. Now, granted, CNN, you may recall back about 1984, CNN did an investigative piece on the Bentwaters case. But it was not until 1986 that Japanese airliner flying out of Alaska reported seeing that huge walnut-shaped object that later was verified through FAA tapes. Do you recall that?
Yes, I do.
Well, then a year or so later, speaking metaphorically, the dam broke. William Moore and Jamie Chandra came out with the MJ-12 papers. Mm-hmm. And almost immediately on the heels of that, John Lear came out with his hypothesis, which now we're really talking some wazoo stuff. How did that help or hurt the overall UFO field from the standpoint of media taking a look at it?
Well, I think my personal opinion is that a lot of these people that are involved in the UFO topic are there to muddy the waters and to create psychological disincentives, if you want to put it that way, to look into the subject further. In other words, their job is to confuse people, to create controversy and dissent, to sow disinformation, basically. So
intentionally or unintentionally?
Intentionally. Well, I mean, sometimes it's unintentional, but I think intentionally quite often.
So your personal belief concerning documents like MJ-12, real or not?
I have an open mind about the MJ-12 documents. It seems to me that the government would have had to have had something like MJ-12. That's just the way the government works. I mean, they would have set up some sort of investigation, and it would have been staffed by the kinds of people listed in MJ-12. I don't know whether all of the MJ-12 documents are reliable, that some of them may be a mixture of truth
Now, I'm not talking about the recent documents purported to be MJ-12 from the people, for example, like Ryan Wood. I'm talking about the original documents.
Yeah.
Per Moore and Chandra.
Yeah. As I say, I don't know for sure what's going on there. I think it's a very complicated issue. And there's no question that the intelligence community is deeply interested and involved in monitoring what the UFO community is doing, and they do sow disinformation through certain kinds of channels, certain people that are useful for their purposes, if you want to put it that way.
Well, now, let's take a look at that for a second. In 1989, the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, was holding their annual symposium down in Las Vegas, Nevada. And at that time, of all people who was in charge of MUFON for the state of Nevada, was Mr. John Lear. And during that symposium, one of the premier speakers was none other than William Moore. Now, Moore, in connection with Charlie Berlitz, wrote the very first book on the Roswell incident that came out circa 1980, thereabouts.
Yeah.
And Moore got up in front of that packed auditorium and stated for the record, in front of hundreds and hundreds of people that came to hear him speak, that he was part and partial of a disinformation campaign mounted by intelligence agents directed at certain people within the UFO research arena. Now, one would think that when somebody came out and made an announcement like that, that even though mainstream media may not like the subject of UFOs, an intelligence operation mounted against an American citizen that ultimately caused that person to enter a psychiatric facility would be major news.
Yeah, it ought to be. It ought to be if you assume that the media companies are in the business of informing the public, but I'm not sure that that's really what they're in business for.
Well, Terry, in your opinion, what is it that we or the public can do, if anything, to change that?
Well, I think the UFO issue is one part of a much larger problem with the U.S. government, and that is that starting in about 1947, whether by coincidence or because of the UFO phenomenon, the nature of the U.S. government was transformed by something called the National Security Act of 1947, and that created a mechanism whereby funds could be pulled out of the U.S. government budget and siphoned off into other kinds of activities. And it set in motion a whole series of developments which radically changed the nature of the U.S. government. It made the government less transparent and less accountable. And unless we deal with those root political issues and overturn those laws, we probably will never know what's going on inside the U.S. government again, and we will have lost our form of government that we set out to create back in the 200 years ago or over 200 years ago.
Well, basically, you're talking about 1947 during the administration of President Harry Truman. Now, when he signed into law the National Security Act, I don't know how many people recognize what a historic thing that was, but in essence, what he did was take the American Republic, and depending upon circumstances, the government could suddenly, with what they felt to be just cause, sweep away every constitutional guarantee there is if they deemed it necessary. Now, that's something that's very seldom spoken about, but I think that's something that everybody in this country should be aware of.
Yep, they ought to be aware of it, and they ought to be very alarmed about it, in fact. I don't think there's a good book by Daniel Moynihan, former Senator Moynihan, just called Secrecy, and he traces the rise of the so-called secret government and how gradually over time our constitutional framework has been eroded by this series of so-called national security initiatives. And the government today is a very different animal from what we were all taught when we were in civics classes and things of that nature when we were younger. It's a very different animal, and some alarming things are happening out there, so people ought to be very vigilant.
Well, When we go back and look at probably one of the, historically, one of the most dangerous times in the last century was at the height of the Second World War. Now, the United States and its allies were in a life-death struggle with two absolutely huge and evil empires, Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan. And when you look at some of the things that happened during the Second World War, in retrospect, it literally it will make you ill. The barbarity of it was just beyond belief. But yet, at the very height of the war, when we were engaged, we, the Americans, were engaged in the Manhattan Project, arguably one of the most top-secret projects ever, we did not have a National Security Act. Now, don't you find it fascinating that 2 years after the end of the war, that this was signed into law, immediately following the on the heel of arguably another amazing thing, the Roswell incident, literally weeks after the Roswell incident.
Yeah, that's right, and I'm inclined to think that that was not a coincidence. The creation of the Central Intelligence Agency was another very controversial movement. There was a long debate in Congress over whether the United States was creating a kind of American Gestapo by creating the CIA, because the CIA was given tremendous powers, and particularly powers to use propaganda to basically deceive the public in all sorts of ways. And they've used those powers extensively in many different arenas since.
Absolutely. And you know what I find, however, that is as surprising? Now, when, and incidentally, this came from more than just the person I'm about to mention, but when I was interviewing Ms. Donna Tietze Hare about her time at NASA, she stated that the airbrushing and all those types of alleged secret events that she claims to have witnessed was not conducted, according to her, by CIA, but by another federal agency that's behind all communications and everything happening in space, the NSA, the National Security Agency. And I found that very, very interesting when she stated that, because it's not often that an organization like NSA is mentioned in the press.
Yeah, that's right. It's keeps a pretty low profile. I think the CIA takes a lot of the flack for what goes on, but there's a lot of other large intelligence bureaucracies. Naval intelligence is another one that's I think has been deeply involved in the UFO topic, but you very seldom hear anything about naval intelligence.
Well, you know, it's very surprising that Donald Kehoe, back in the 50s, of course, one of the premier lights of legitimate and responsible UFO research and reporting, talked about the Navy or Naval Secretary during the end days of the Truman administration, who was flying back to continental United States from Hawaii, and their aircraft was buzzed by an unidentified flying object. Are you familiar with this incident?
I think I am slightly. You'll have to refresh me on the details.
Well, when he got back to the States, he was just absolutely, you know, he couldn't believe what they had witnessed, and immediately went to the Air Force and said, hey, this is what happened. What was it? And in essence, the Air Force gave the Navy Secretary the brush off, which absolutely outraged this fellow, which, according to Kehoe, created quite a rift, and somehow Navy then became extremely involved and were much more secret and covert about this subject than even the Air Force had been.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised. Just a footnote to that story is when I was in junior high school, one of my teachers was Donald Kehoe's sister. So I knew, you know, at the time when a lot of this was happening, the subject of UFOs would come up occasionally in class, And unfortunately, I never met Donald Kehoe, but I know he did visit his sister in Ottumwa, Iowa there at the time I was living there. So I crossed paths, but never actually met him.
Well, there's a man that I would have loved to have met. Look, Terry, we've got to take our very last break. And when we come back, we're going to finish up this absolutely fascinating interview with my guest, Mr. Terry Hansen, author of The Missing Times, News Media Complicity in the UFO Cover-Up. Stay tuned. And we are back. This is Dark Matters Radio, and my very special guest, Mr. Terry Hansen, author of The Missing Times. And I'll tell you, hey, ladies and gentlemen, if you have even a slight interest in this subject, and you want to find out what the real, honest, and in-depth story is, go to Amazon.com. Look up The Missing Times, author Terry Hansen, and buy that book. I'm telling you, this is going to open your eyes beyond any shadow of a doubt. And Terry also has a website. Go to www.themissingtimes.com. You can read all about Terry, his background, his biography, how you can get a copy of this vitally important book. Terry, we are back. What other thoughts did you have on your mind? You had mentioned a certain newspaper, shall we say, that's rather famous or, depending on your point of view, infamous in the United States.
Yeah, a lot of people, you know, we talked earlier about the Robertson panel, the CIA's panel that wanted to debunk UFOs via the mass media. Well, one publication that covered the UFO subject extensively for a long time was the National Enquirer. And, of course, the National Enquirer is not regarded in intellectual circles as a reliable source of information for a variety of reasons. But actually, the reporting that the National Enquirer did was on UFOs was often quite accurate and based on real events. But what people don't know about the National Enquirer is that the guy who started it, Gene Pope, did a stint in the CIA's psychological warfare department before somehow finding the money to buy a newspaper that eventually became the National Enquirer.
Now, as Allison, the Looking Glass, would say, huh, things get curiouser and curiouser.
Yep, they absolutely do. Pope was the son of another gentleman who owned a very influential East Coast newspaper called Il Progresso, and so he was in the newspaper business. And he evidently somehow became rubbed shoulders with the CIA or the OSS in the early years of the of Il Progresso, because Il Progresso was being monitored by the OSS, which was the predecessor of the CIA. So he had some involvement with the intelligence community then. But after he had a little fallout with his family and lost control of the Il Progresso, he went to work for the Central Intelligence Agency in what he said was the Psychological Warfare Division. After he'd been there a relatively short time, he left the CIA, and he suddenly had a lot of money in his pocket, and he went out and bought a newspaper from the Hearst chain, and that eventually became the National Enquirer. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that this little concept of using a tawdry tabloid to discredit political movements or ideas had been used by the CIA in other contexts.
Well, that's in their handbook, is it not?
Yeah, it's one of their kind of standard little tricks that they use to play games with people's heads. And I think, you know, most people know when you go through the checkout stand, you see these tabloids, and they always have a ridiculous story about aliens shaking hands with Ronald Reagan or something like that. Well, that little trick is a very effective propaganda tool that the intelligence community has used many times before in other contexts. So it's significant, I think, that Gene Pope had these ties to the CIA and also very close ties to the Nixon White House.
Well, Terry, believe it or not, we are out of time, my friend. I want to thank you very, very deeply for coming on here. This has been a fascinating program, and let me publicly invite you to come back very soon.
Okay, I'll do that.
The name of the book, The Missing Times, author Terry Hansen. You can find it on Amazon.com or go to www.themissingtimes.com. This has been Dark Matters Radio, and we're going to be back real soon, so please keep tuning in. Terry, have a good day.
Good day to you, Don. I mentioned the book, but I was never invited on by Art.